This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we're taking a look at the state of trash in our counties, present and future. Today we focus in on Oahu. It's home to close to 1 million people and sees the lion's share of close to 10 million visitors a year. Today our most recent addition to the newsroom, HPR reporter Ashley Mizuo, spotlights the dilemma of the island's only landfill.
Every day, trucks like this one roll down Farrington Highway, dumping waste in Oahu's only municipal landfill, Waimanalo Gulch. The city landfill opened 30 years ago, and Waianae Senator Maile Shimabukuro says that's long enough.
The community has been told time and time again that landfill would in fact close, but each time the closure date comes around, the city seeks an extension. I mean, definitely there's a feeling of just in general environmental injustice for our whole coastline.
Waimanalo Gulch is on land designated for agricultural use. That means the State Land Use Commission has to issue a special use permit allowing the landfill to continue operating. 3 months ago, the commission said the landfill must close by 2028. That may sound like a long time, but the previous city administration said it would take 7 years to open a new landfill, at least.
I'm not sure I agree with the 7 years. You know, in fairness to them, my predecessors have said that. It takes 7 years to site a new landfill. I think it takes longer than that.
That's Lori Kahikina, the current director of the Honolulu Department of Environmental Services. She says starting a new landfill means picking a location, acquiring the land if the city doesn't own it, and putting together an environmental impact statement. And then there's design and construction phases. Kahikina says 2028 is too soon to close it.
This is my personal feelings. It's a waste of taxpayers' money because we have so many years left on Waimanalo Gulch. And I know the Leeward Coast people are going to be really upset at me for saying that because I know the Leeward Coast feels they're dumped on.
Ahmad Sadri is a disposal and operations engineer at Waimanalo Gulch. He says H-Power, the city's waste-to-energy incinerator, has helped cut the number of trucks going to Waimanalo Gulch by 80 to 90%.
Our current projections give us, I think it's about 20 years of life left, and that's combined ash and MSW. But that, of course, could change with future technology and future diversion.
2 years ago, Mayor Kirk Caldwell commissioned a study to look at the top choices for the next landfill. 11 choices were ranked, and 2 of the top 5 candidates are on the leeward side. Number 1 is Upland Nanakuli, on land owned by the state. The city's contract with H-Power runs for another 12 years, and it requires a landfill, in part as backup, but also to take the 19,000 tons of ash produced each year by the power plant. The city wants to reuse the ash as construction aggregate and has put out a request for proposals to develop a plan for an ash facility. Those are due later this month, and a plan will be selected in mid-March. The city officials hope to build the facility before Caldwell leaves his post at the end of the year. A spokesperson from Caldwell's office says it's the mayor who decides on the landfill site, but the city council weighs in when the budget's being drafted. In the meantime, Senator Shimabukuro says the city should continue its efforts to reduce its reliance on landfills.
No one's going to be happy with having a landfill in our backyard, but if it was only for natural disasters and for when H-Power closes, I mean, of course that would be a lot better than what we have now. That could be a compromise. That would be better than nothing.
For Hawaii Public Radio, I'm Ashley Mizuo.
And Ashley joins us in studio now. So Ashley, when you were doing this story, I guess what jumped out at you?
During my talk with Director Kahikina, she mentioned that really this 7 to 8 years is not really that much time and that they really need to kind of get the ball moving. For that reason, she said they would probably not have enough time to recommission another study. So this study is kind of what they'll be looking at. On that study, there's 11 sites. A couple of the more interesting points were who owns the lands that they're on and what kind of land use designations they have.
And so run down the list.
Most of them are owned by privately, except for 2 are owned by the federal government, which would be very difficult for the city to acquire. And then Upland Nanakuli, the number 1 pick, is owned by the state.
So what stands in the way now of actually going through this process and selecting an alternate site?
Mayor Kirk Caldwell has kind of said that he'd rather eliminate the need of a landfill in general before trying to figure out which one he'd like to pick. But as they said in the story, the H-Power requires the city to have a landfill. So they're kind of hoping that they can find some kind of solution potentially to eliminate the need for one for everyday use and maybe just use it for natural disasters or something like that, and for when H-Power isn't able to operate. But they haven't really come up with a way yet, in a concrete way, to get rid of all that ash that they get from H-Power. They're looking to figure out a way to somehow recycle that ash and hope to have some kind of plan picked by March, but they haven't really come out and said what kind of plan that would look like. Yeah, and then there's still some municipal solid waste coming into the land as well that they haven't really figured out quite exactly what to do with that. So they are going to have to probably look at picking a site eventually, although their hope is that they won't have to pick a site at all and they could eliminate that waste.
And then you sat through a number of those meetings at the State Land Use Commission. What else did you learn?
One of the other interesting things at the Land Use Commission is the reason why the city has to keep going back to the Land Use Commission for approval on whether or not they can operate their landfill is because right now Waimanala Gulch is on agricultural land, or land designated as agricultural land, and they're several different kinds of land that the state designates. And out of those four types of land, only urban land would not require a special use permit, which is what Waimanala Gulch needs right now to operate on the agricultural land. And so during the Land Use Commission hearings, they were talking about potentially having the city look into trying to get that land redesignated into urban land so they wouldn't have to keep coming back to the commission to be reapproved for that special permit. The city said that that was kind of the first time they'd ever heard of that option and that they haven't discussed it yet. But the Land Use Commission did say that that is a way that they could go. Not that they would necessarily approve it, but that they could apply to have that land redesignated.
And so how long of a process would that be?
They said it really just varies. They couldn't really give a particular amount of time because it just depends on the permitting and how fast that all the information could be gathered. So they said they had no real time frame for that. In the past, they have challenged the Land Use Commission's decision up to the Hawaii Supreme Court. In 2012, they did that because the Land Use Commission had told the city that they could no longer accept solid waste in 2012, but the Hawaii Supreme Court reversed that decision, and so they were allowed to continue operating. The city hasn't said whether or not they're going to do that again for this decision. However, they did mention that even if they decide to do that, they would still have to start looking for a new landfill site because the deadline is so near.
So at this point, though, I guess they're keeping that option open.
So it seems like right now they're kind of weighing all of their different decisions. But one thing that they did mention is that the time limit to figure out what they're going to do is very small. Like 8 years seems like a long time for us. 8 years, a lot can happen. But in the terms of siting the new landfill, picking the spot, acquiring the land, especially if they pick a private land, they'd have to somehow get it. It could take a really, really long time. And so getting the ball moving on this, I think, has been a little bit difficult for them.
And the mayor's term is almost up.
Yeah, and it's almost up. And he said that he really is looking for a way to not have to burden another community with this landfill. And he would like to somehow eliminate the need for an everyday landfill. But again, they haven't really found a way to do that necessarily. They have been able to divert quite a bit of municipal waste with H-Power. But H-Power does produce a very sizable amount of tonnage of ash, and so until they can deal with that and as well as whatever is left on the municipal waste side, they're still going to have to find a place to put it, and they have about 8 years to figure out where they're going to be moving next.
Okay. All right. No easy answer on this.
No.
Thank you so much, Ashley.
Thank you.
That was HPR's newest reporter, Ashley Mizuo, focusing on Oahu's Opala. We'll continue our look at the trash issues across the state this week and next.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio. Everything you always wanted to know about meat.
In developing countries, consumers want to add high-value proteins to their diet.
And the future of meat, including meatless meat.
We're going to make meat that's more delicious and better nutritionally and more affordable.
That's next time on Freakonomics Radio.
This evening at 7, following Counterspin.
This is The Conversation on statewide, member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. For today's quiz, we ask you to sit back and listen closely to your speakers. We're going to play an excerpt from a CD that found its way into our backyard. Recording in 2002, a local musician sings of a castaway dog lost on the high seas. Her plight touched the public's heart and purse strings, both here in Hawaii and abroad. You might remember some of the details. The crew of a burned-out tanker adrift in the Pacific was rescued in waters south of the Big Island. In the mayhem of changing vessels, the captain's pet terrier was left behind. After two failed rescue attempts, the Coast Guard eventually located the ghost tanker near Johnson Atoll. Take a listen.
The big day was Friday, April 26th. Two men from the tug, the American Quest, found her hiding under some big old tire, looking frail and rather spent. The news had rippled all around the world. She's safe and she's coming home. Da-da, da-da-da-da. Da-da-da.
For today's quiz, we want to know the name of this lucky little dog, and bonus points if you can name the artist singing the song. Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you think you know the answer, the first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from the realtors and staff of Locations, proudly supporting HPR's commitment to sharing stories of Hawaii's people and places. Locations, welcome home.
It is believed to be the largest ever gathering of astronomers ever on the planet. The American Astronomical Society has drawn some 3,400 scientists to the Hawaii Convention Center. Douglas Duncan is the former director of the Fisk Planetarium at the University of Colorado at Boulder and is a professor there. In addition to teaching the subject, Duncan is studying how best to teach science to college students interested in the study of space.
There's quite a bit of educational research that is always being done, but surprisingly little has to do with university students. So, of course, it's important to study how to teach young kids and so on, but we have the specialty of students who are trying to learn science for their career. What happens in the university classroom? Because, you know, a lot of times the classes are big. It's not as personal as you might get when you were, you know, a fifth grader. So how does that all work, and what should the professor be doing, and what should the student be doing in order to successfully learn?
Now, you're at University of Colorado at Boulder.
That's
and
right.
And when my son was starting school there many years ago, we were required to buy an iClicker.
Yes. A lot of universities and colleges are using a little something that looks like a TV control, about the same size, but it just has A, B, C, D, E on it. And when the teacher wants to know if the students are understanding, instead of her or him asking, does anyone have any questions? You know, that's a wasted thing to do because everyone just looks around and they're all afraid to put up their hand and look stupid. This is much, much better because every single student in the classroom can choose A, B, C, D, E, and then a little receiver plugs into the teacher's laptop and instantly shows what percentage of the students gave each answer. So the teacher may be cruising right along and has just explained something and is sure that it's crystal clear to every student in the classroom because they're all smiling, and then looks at the results. Oh my God, only half the class gets it. So it's so valuable both to the teacher and to the student to get immediate feedback. So much better than waiting for an exam.
Right.
You know, you can learn every day, oh, what am I understanding and what am I not?
But I think that's the beauty of it, really, is the technology. And so how do we use those advances to, you know, help our understanding and help, you know, our young minds understand what we're trying to teach them?
Well, and we try and be very careful about this. So I wouldn't want anyone to misinterpret what I'm saying as meaning technology is always helpful. I give a presentation, in fact, at this conference called Technology, the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. So you've just described some technology, which is very good. And as a matter of fact, if we give constant feedback to our university students like this, if we ask them questions that are kind of challenging and where they realize they don't, they might not understand. In fact, we even ask them to pair up. And when we ask a question, both the student and their neighbors on both sides, so a group of three, have to agree on what the answer is. And as they explain it to each other, they really learn it much better when they put it into their own words. And we can take a whole class and move them up half a grade. They learn significantly more if instead of just passively listening, they get to talk about what the correct answer is and to think about it and share it with their neighbors. So that's what I would call a good technology.
Right, you get them engaged.
Right, but there, of course, is bad and ugly technology as well.
Yeah, like your cell phone, right? That can be bad,
well,
too.
Well, and my little research group is pretty well known as having done the first research on texting and student grades. And we studied about 1,000 students in 10 different courses. And what we found is 75% of college students right now are texting while the professor is speaking. And, you know, they're not doing that to disrespect the person, although there are some issues about that too. You know, do you talk to a person and say, oh, just excuse me, I got to do a text? But the most important thing is students think they can multitask and they can't. So not only did we determine that about 75% of college students text during class, but we wanted to see what effect it had on their grades. And this is why I call it the bad technology, because the high texters lose almost half of a grade. You know, if you're a B student, but you're texting during class, it drops you to a C plus. On the other hand, if you're a B student used to texting and you put the phone away without doing anything else, all of a sudden you're a B plus student. So it really has a much larger impact on students' understanding than they think.
So how do you get them to not text while you're teaching the class?
Well, you know, the first thing is to show them what a difference it makes, that they think they can multitask, but if they're only listening with half their brain, when it comes time for an exam and they have to explain something or answer a question, they're going to do much worse. So for some students, just realizing that by flicking a switch and putting their phone away for an hour, they're going to improve their grades, well, quite a few students do that. But it's still very tempting. There actually was a functional MRI study of students and texting, and it found that every time you get a little text from your friend, there's a buzz that goes off in your brain. It's like a drug. It actually is like a drug. So no wonder that students seem to be addicted to their phone. So sometimes they need a little help. And we have been experimenting with, of all things, an app that you put on your phone, and it keeps you from using your own phone during class. It's kind of a clever idea. This little piece of software puts a screen on your phone, and if it's an emergency or if you really want to do something on your phone, you can make that screen go away, right? Just hit the bottom of the phone, and that app closes, and you can use your other apps. But the thing which is really clever is this app knows when your class starts and ends, and it knows who you are because you register for it, and it sends me as the teacher a report at the end of class who was on their phone and who was not. And it's really very interesting, and this is ongoing research, and so we're in the middle of it. I can only give you some preliminary findings, but I gave my students 2% extra credit if they used this app all the way through the last semester. And so they earned a little bit of extra credit. If they used it half the time, they got 1%. And so that helped be an incentive to keep people off their phones. But I told them that if they were paying 100% attention to the class, they'd probably score quite a bit higher on the exams. And my first analysis of the results is the people who use this app all the time and stayed off their phones scored about 5% higher. So you really won big in my class. If you tried out this experimental app, you got 2% credit for using it, but you got 5% better score on the exams. And so you probably raised your grade almost a full grade. And what I think is equally interesting is I'm starting to get comments from the students. And I can tell you anonymously, because this research always keeps the students anonymous, that quite a few of them are saying it was really nice to have an hour when my friends didn't expect me to instantly respond to them. And I think this doesn't just apply to students. I think anybody in the working world can appreciate this too. Some tasks really require your concentration. And if you get a text every 10 minutes, you really can't focus to the extent that you may need to. Now, of course, there are a lot of tasks that don't require a lot of concentration. And so there's a wonderful book by a Nobel Prize winner, Daniel Kahneman, and it's called Thinking Fast and Slow. And our brain has evolved to do both. There are some things we instantly come to a conclusion on, and that can be good or bad. You know, I think we evolved to recognize danger, and so it only takes you a fraction of a second to react to something, you know, happening at night, you hear a noise, something like that. Unfortunately, it also means you often make judgments about people within a second of just seeing them. But we have the ability to think more deeply and carefully. And of course, that's one reason I love public radio, is as compared to a TV program where they say, oh, this is a long segment, it's a minute and a half. Here at public radio, we can think about things and discuss them in more depth. And people can do that if they take the time. And if you're trying to be really creative, or if you're trying to learn something which is complicated, maybe in science, it really does. It takes your whole brain, and you have to think about it for a while.
So now you're testing this out with your classes, and you're teaching science. Does it vary?
Surprisingly little. I think, and at the University of Colorado, we have a really unique situation. We have a physicist who won the Nobel Prize in 2002. He created a new form of matter. And then he came back and he shocked everybody and he said, well, okay, now I'm stopping that research. And I'm starting brand new research on college students and professors as they try and teach and learn physics. And to his credit, he hustled up $5 million from various sources and put a lot of good people in the same building. And we all share what we're learning from doing experiments, you know, not just philosophizing, but what really helps the students learn. Do they really lose when they text on their phone? Yes, and we've measured it, and it's half a grade. Do they really win? Do they learn more when they talk to their neighbor and get constant feedback with these little clickers? Yes, that's worth half a grade higher. So we have the resources and the people to do experiments, and it doesn't seem to matter whether you're trying to learn chemistry or astronomy, my field, or I suspect if you're trying to learn almost anything else. If it's at all complex, you need to focus your brain on it and not be distracted and have a little bit of time. I haven't done any experiments on this, but I strongly suspect that the reason people who write novels often rent a cabin, you know, either up in the mountains in Colorado or off the grid here in Hawaii, is so they can have some uninterrupted time to really create a wonderful novel and to think about characters and how
focus,
they would and to focus. So it's kind of ironic, but a precious currency in today's world is quiet. You know, it's privacy. As a matter of fact, you know, I had enough miles that I could fly back and forth business class and be in the business class lounge. And what is it that they offer you inside there? Quiet. You don't hear all the announcements and all the commotion that you would hear otherwise. And that certainly helps our brains focus and be creative.
That's worth something.
But what a sad situation that you have to pay for quiet. I think resourceful people still would find a way. You go on a walk, you give yourself a chance to think and be creative.
Now, you were just next door at the conference, and in order for me to communicate with you, I had to text you.
That's very true. And, you know, one of the problems was information overload. There are so many astronomers in Honolulu right now that they have three sets of talks simultaneously all day long. One's in one room, one in another, and one in another. So, yes, that's very true.
So it would be interesting to see how many astronomers were texting during the sessions that they were going to.
Indeed.
Well, that'd be another research project for you.
You know, I think in the working world, it's definitely a problem. You know, I've read articles about by many people, I'm the boss, what do I do when I call a meeting and I find two people at the other end of the table are texting and not listening to me? As a matter of fact, I can tell you that when it comes to NASA, NASA tried to save money. There are often meetings within NASA, and some of them are NASA people and some are people at universities. There might be some people from Lockheed all talking about the next satellite in space or what's going to follow the Hubble telescope. So you go to a lot of meetings in almost any professional career. And NASA thought, maybe we'll save money and everyone will Skype or everyone will Zoom. Well, I don't know if NASA's admitted this publicly yet, but what they quickly learned is that people would have one window open for Zoom and another window open for their other work. And NASA was only getting half their attention. And that isn't good enough. You know, if you're going to go into space, you can't get halfway there.
Well, there's a lot of quiet in space, I imagine, to get there.
Yeah, so NASA gave up on having so many meetings remotely and decided it was worthwhile to pay for the air ticket and to gather everybody in one room and to have them all focused on the task at hand.
And they'll have to get that special app to make sure they're not on the phone texting.
That just might be true. By the way, for those who are intrigued, it's called Flipped, F-L-I-P-D. And you can just get it yourself and put it on your phone and say, I want to have half an hour of quiet. And tell this app to keep you off your own phone for half an hour.
Right. Train yourself and slap your hand if you push the button. Well, Doug Duncan, thank you so much. We appreciate your time.
It's a great pleasure.
Douglas Duncan teaches astronomy at UC Boulder, and he presented his research at the Conference of the American Astronomical Society. Over the years, Duncan has been a regular science contributor on Colorado Public Radio and WBEZ in Chicago.
Next time on The World.
Last night, at my direction, the United States military successfully.
President Trump's decision to kill a top Iranian general raises big questions about how national security decisions are being made and how they're supposed to be made.
Qasem Soleimani.
We look at the power of the executive when it comes to war. Checks and balances in the age of Trump on The World.
Starting this afternoon at 1.
Our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat have our daily dose of reality today. Chad Blair on the line with the latest on an audit on the city's Department of Planning and Permitting. Hi, Chad.
Good morning, Catherine.
So tell us more about this story. That poor department's just been beaten up all this past year.
Well, talk about reality check. I think one of the things we've heard many times over the years and the decades that an obstacle to getting building going projects is the Department of Planning and Permitting. Now, mind you, DPP controls Oahu, but that's where the bulk of the population is, the bulk of the projects. And the permitting process has taken a long time, anecdotally, to get projects up to speed. That's really frustrating to the building industry, which is trying to meet a demand. Well, this new report, which is from Christina Jedra, who can't be here today because she's at the Capitol covering one of those briefings that's going on. There's a new audit that actually gives some credence to that anecdotal evidence that there's something going on at DPP that takes too long to review these permit applications. And there's few controls that are in place. Lax controls is actually the word that she used in her report, that aren't allowing these projects to go through, these permits to be approved. And that's frustrating a lot of folks.
You know, there was a time when this department was actually two departments. It was the building department and the Department of land use. and they reorganized it, changed the city charter, and then it became one. But it's a good thing to have an audit to say, okay, is this really as efficient as it can be?
Yeah. Are things really being done in a timely manner? And bottom line, the city auditor is saying no. It gave a couple of examples that were a little bit shocking. One is the fact that private companies apparently are gaming the permit system, the application system, which is disadvantaging other folks that are trying to get their permits through. The audit actually cites a company, does not identify the company, but says this company in particular has monopolized the appointment system. And what they do is they book under alternative names. In other words, it's the same company using different names to use up more appointment times. And in that business in this particular case booked 21%, one-fifth, of the appointment slots that were available over a year. So that's just one example of where the system is really not being supervised properly and people are, as the report said, gaming the system.
Yeah, I mean, that's just not right for everybody else.
And here's another thing that kind of leapt off the page. There has been an effort to try and move things through. In fact, though, a lot of permits carry over year to year, about 2,500 total. Well, I can understand they may not be able to get to all those permits, but here's another statistic. Over the last 5 years, applications have actually declined 21%. Well, if you're having a one-fifth decline in the number of people applying, why are the same number on average of permits carrying over year to year? So that's another concern. I should say that DPP would not comment directly on what the audit said, but is recognizing that there are concerns, findings, and conclusions that were brought forth in the audit have been broadly accepted. I'm going to use that word in quote marks, broadly accepted by DPP. But again, to be clear, they would not comment formally to Civil Beat about the audit's findings.
Now, I know that they do have a problem with unemployment being so low. And I'm sure they've probably got some open positions.
Yeah, in fact, there are recommendations that the auditor says could be helpful. I'll just give you a couple of them. One of them is low pay. The positions generally are not paying enough. That's not helpful when you're trying to attract a skilled workforce, because that's another thing that was identified by the audit, that you have people with not necessarily the right skill set in place to help process these permits. There's low morale in general. You can imagine how that low pay is contributing to that, as well as the burden of the workload itself. There's also been a lot of turnover, some supervising problems and finally a lack of proper training, all those things combined together. And that's why the auditor is recommending the DPP look to up the skill set, to up the pay to attract more qualified people to process these permits.
Yeah, and I think during the fall, if I recall, DPP set aside a day where, you know, they don't have to do a lot of interaction with the public because they needed the staff to focus on, you know, the plans coming in.
Yeah, DPP, to its credit, to the auditor's observations, it has implemented some new policies. It has had some progress in changes, the one that you mentioned. But the bottom line, the auditor is saying you need to do more. This was another thing that kind of stood out. The auditor apparently spoke to a former director. I wonder who that is. They wouldn't identify who that is. But, you know, when you don't identify, sometimes you get someone to sort of spill the beans. And one of the things that the auditor found was that they had a one-time review program that was implemented about 2 years ago, a year and a half ago. And this is for 1 to 2 family unit dwellings, right? Pretty small construction site. It's not like you're building a big tower. Well, it turns out that they processed only 9 of those 29 permits meeting that criteria. Why did it take? I mean, here you are basically trying to expedite, get through these programs, these applications for projects that are just not that huge. And yet, even in this case, they were not able to meet the right criteria to move the process forward and get those buildings under construction.
Right. And I recall there was a time when there was a huge backlog on permits over the years.
And
I know that, you know, they have really tried to do things to expedite the process, you know, whether it's reviewing for buildings that are 50 years or older or, you know, the solar permits. I mean, they really have kind of risen to the challenge to try and beat back the backlog, but
right.
Obviously room for improvement.
Yeah. And one final thing real quickly, you know, you actually pay for those permits. The people that apply, there's a fee associated. Well, guess what? If you're not processing that permit, the fees are not coming into the coffers of DPP, and that, of course, is city and county money. So
right.
Something else to think about.
Okay. All right. Well, we'll see what happens after this audit.
Thanks, Catherine.
All righty. That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. Read Christina Jedra's. Go to civilbeat.org. Go online.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Aloha Theater on Hawaii Island, hosting the 9th Annual Kona Jazz Experience, showcasing students from the Big Island Music Academy this Saturday. Tickets at alohatheater.com.
In today's quiz, we shared a piece of maritime history that was put to music by Henry Kapono. His collectible CD was produced for the Hawaiian Humane Society, and on it, he sings of the heartwarming rescue of a little terrier who was lost at sea. She was the pet of a Taiwanese ship captain, and the tanker they were sailing had been disabled by fire. The human crew members were rescued by a passing cruise ship over 200 miles south of the Big Island. But sadly, the little dog was left to drift aimlessly on the ocean on the ghost ship. And once word got out of the pooch's predicament, people in Hawaii and around the world started sending money to the Hawaiian Humane Society and other organizations to fund rescue efforts. It's estimated that more than $280,000 was spent to save the terrier named Hoket. After a couple of failed attempts, the Coast Guard eventually boarded the crippled oil tanker near Johnson Atoll and brought the ship and the lucky pooch back to Honolulu on May 2, 2002. Hoket in Taiwanese means happiness, good fortune, and blessing. And congratulations to winner Nita from Honolulu. She remembers Hoket getting a lifetime supply of dog food. And Eric of Makiki, he got our bonus points naming Henry Kapono. And thanks to the Henry Kapono fan who shared the Tale of the Dog CD with us. That's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Coming Saturday, January 25th, Hawaii Opera Theater brings a collection of operettas, musical theater, and more, all by American composers, to the intimate and acoustically rich HPR Atherton Studio. Experience song on stage in a whole new way. Station members enjoy discounted pricing. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. Sponsored by Bonnie Rice and the Rice Partnership Wealth Management.
After chronicling the lives of girls for 25 years, Peggy Orenstein has turned her attention to boys in the Me Too era and how they're constrained by gender roles and ideals of masculinity. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with her about her new book, Boys and Sex, Young Men on Hookups, Love, Porn, Consent, and Navigating the New Masculinity. Join us.
Starting this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
You know, this past week, the Trust for Public Land announced a deal that will allow for more than 700 acres to remain protected for agriculture and for the future of the Ka'u community. It is one of five parcels identified as conservation projects on the Big Island. You know, this deal in particular is thanks to money from the Freeman Foundation. We talked to two people with ties to Ka'u. Keone Fox is the director of the Ala Kalakai Trail Association, and Michelle Galimba is of the Kuahiwi Ranch. Her family has worked in livestock in Ka'u and feels more connected as the Galimbas now own the land they ranch. Keone Fox talked with us about the conservation easement and the sites it will help protect.
My mom's family is from Ka'u, and our family is actually from this land, from this property. And for years, we've been trying to work with the landowner to preserve an array of cultural sites and burial sites found on the property. Previously, the property was owned by C. Brewer, which became Ka'u Agribusiness, and then was sold when the plantation closed back in 1996. And it was sold to a realtor who had been looking to develop the property. It was over the years I became associated with the Trail Association, which is committed to protecting the ancient historic trail that goes around the island. And it goes through, it actually goes on the Mackay side of this property, but there are some lateral Malcolm Mackay trails that cross through Kavala that will be protected as part of this conservation easement, not to mention my own family cultural sites and many of our family burials as well. You know, my family's very grateful that the Ala Kalakai Trail Association really came to our aid, helped to preserve something that's so special to not just my family, but the entire community of Ka'u, and as well as the Freeman family for providing the funding, and of course the Galimbas Kuahiwi Ranch for just being willing to consider doing something like this.
Right. And for the Galimbas, I mean, they finally own the land that they've been ranching.
Correct. And I think for them, it gives them, it empowers them to feel a lot more invested, you know, in the property that they're using. And they can make decisions that are really better for the community as a whole.
Anything else that you want to share just about that particular place and the history?
So Kavala is well discussed in a book called Native Planters. It was actually written by a couple named Handy and Handy, and a lot of the information that they received for the book was from Auntie Mary Kavenapakui, the revered, well-known Hawaiian historian whose family was actually from Ka'u. And it talks a lot about the heiau that's on the property, the importance of using the caves to collect water from underground springs, and also just some of the links to other properties here in Ka'u.
I'm sure the community was maybe concerned about potential development with the previous owners.
In 2004, the property was purchased from Ka'u Agribusiness, and almost immediately we saw applications come in for subdivisions. And now, this has been a concern for the community for years. There's been a threat about having these large luxury-style gated communities in Ka'u where you haven't never seen it before. And people are very passionate about protecting their open space, the 80 miles of coastline. It's something that's very cherished by the people of Kau. And I think people were concerned that a development like that really would have changed the community's character.
And Michelle Galimba of Kuahibi Ranch is grateful so many groups came together to try and keep Kau Kau. Ranching isn't easy. It can be really hard, particularly in an area in the shadow of the volcano, which has heavily influenced life in that community over many centuries.
This area has not been developed and really had some really catastrophic events happened in the late 1800s that left a lot of sort of villages from that time period more or less intact, the landscape. And so I've always grown up around, you know, these archaeological sites and burials and also and around the open space that's out here. And so I have a lot of respect for that. And people in general in Kau really do have a lot of respect for that sort of heritage of agriculture and the presence of the past.
Right, the cultural resource.
Yeah, we call them cultural resources now, which is, it has different names over time. But yeah, I think it's just part of sort of the ethos of living out here in Kau is that respect and desire to preserve it. And we just want to, you know, ranch. That's like our vision is like we just want to ranch it. So those two things more or less go together. They have gone together in the past. So, and that dovetails with what Keone is very interested in, is also preserving that heritage. And I've gotten to know him slowly over the years. So it just kind of worked out that what he is interested in, what we are interested in, what the community is interested in, all dovetailed. And then we were very lucky to have support from Trust for Public Land and from the Freeman Foundation.
Yeah, so talk about that. Talk about the support with the Freeman Foundation.
They're from the East Coast, and so they have a connection to that sort of small family farm heritage there. So I think this is a continuation for them of some projects that they do more with, like, Vermont dairies. I think it's new for what they generally do here in Hawaii and the Pacific, but it's not necessarily new for their sort of larger picture. Yeah, they've just been so great to work with.
So this conservation easement then will ensure that the trail is protected and then that land is kept in agriculture.
The main Alakahakai Trail doesn't go through the parcel that we bought. But there are some subsidiary trails, some Malcolm Mackay trails that go through it, but it's also the other kinds of sites, cultural resources. Those will be protected. And, I mean, it's an ongoing process, really. So I think Keone and I will probably be working together for many, many years, working out, you know, the details of preserving both agriculture and cultural heritage.
Talk about the effect of the volcano that we saw, like, you know, this past year, because you had so many farmers and ranchers, you know, that were forced to evacuate because of the lava,
right,
and the ash and just the poor air quality.
We didn't have to deal with lava coming down on us, although that is a possibility here, and that's part of the depopulation of this area. We had catastrophic lava events in the late 1800s from Mauna Loa. But this, for this episode, it was just heavy ash. It was pretty scary, you know, just because that ash was so thick for a few weeks. It really got on all of the vegetation. Obviously, probably didn't taste very good to the cattle. I mean, it was kind of scary of thinking about, you know, the size of our operation. Like, if this went on for years and years, like, what do you do? But luckily, it you know, wasn't as intense after a few weeks. We've definitely had effects on, because that sort of that eruption was the end of a long, very slow eruption with a lot of fog that, you know, everyone in the state suffered through. But we got it quite a lot, and we did have, you know, effects on, like, our fencing would corrode three times as fast as it would before the fog. The biggest challenge really is always weather and not being able to tell what the weather is going to be, and that has intensified. And, you know, over the time that we've been ranching, say, like, the first 10 years that we were ranching or 15 years, there was a pretty regular cycle, and so you could plan. And I'd say probably for the last 10 years or so, it's been extremely unpredictable. So, yeah, you kind of have to be very defensive in your thinking about making sure that you have, you know, the grass and the water.
What are the markets for your cattle? Where do they end up?
Half of our cattle we keep here, and we fatten them on grass. So they're 100% grass-fed, and they are sold to supermarkets like Foodland and Whole Foods, and some restaurants like Town, Volcano House. And then we also have a farmer's market stand. So there's two slaughterhouses on this island, and we use both of them. And so we ship weekly, we ship our animals to those slaughterhouses, and then from there it, you know, goes to the supermarket. I think there's been a few other similar conservation easements on ranch land in Hawaii, but it's still sort of a new thing that I really hope that it can work out for other people, because I think it's a really great thing to be able to do agriculture and help to preserve the environment and cultural heritage.
That was Michelle Galimba of Kuahibi Ranch on the Big Island talking about a recent deal announced with the Trust for Public Land and the Freeman Foundation that will protect agricultural land and cultural resources in Kau for the future. That's it for today. Up tomorrow, we talk trash on Maui as the newsroom does a deep dive island by island. Call our talkback line. Tell us what you think. The number to do that, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. We are on Facebook at The Conversation, HPR, and Twitter at HI Conversation. And if you missed any of the show or want to find a past one, find them all on The Conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.